From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
الذي أراد أن يضرب صدام حسين فإن الله كانت له سبحانه وتعالى إرادة أخرى.
Any rate,
هكذا كما
whoever wanted,
ترون الآن.
Whoever wanted to hit Saddam Hussein,
الحمد لله على إرادة الله.
It's God's will that has prevailed, not his, because you see what the situation is like nowadays. It is God's will that Saddam Hussein is here and the others are not.
As the Iraqi government opens an investigation into the execution of Saddam Hussein, we'll play one of the only interviews he ever did with an American journalist. He spoke with Emmy Award-winning journalist John Alpert in 1992. And a New Year embarrassment for a possible presidential contender, Rudy Giuliani's top-secret battle plans exposed. We'll speak with journalist Wayne Barrett and filmmaker Kevin Keating and play excerpts from the documentary Giuliani Time.
Giuliani knows what he's doing. He knows when he's violating people's civil rights and constitutional rights. He knows it. He doesn't care. It's a blatant disregard. And when you pass that on down through the chain of command, that's when he gets to the cops.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Iraqi government has ordered an investigation into the display of abusive behavior at the execution of Saddam Hussein. The former Iraqi dictator was hanged at dawn Saturday by a team of Shiite men wearing ski masks. Video recorded on a cell phone shows guards taunting Saddam Hussein in his final moments. Legal observers had called for an independent investigation, but the Iraqi government has appointed the Interior Ministry. U.S. officials are now claiming they made diligent efforts to delay Hussein's execution until the final hours of his life. In an interview with the New York Times, officials say they pushed for the delay in part over doubts about the legality of the execution under international law. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is reporting the Iraqi government has made plans to hang two of Saddam Hussein's co-defendants. Saddam Hussein's half-brother, former intelligence chief Barzan Ibrahim al-Tikriti, and Awad Hamid al-Bandar, the former chief justice of the Revolutionary Court, expected to be put to death Thursday. In other news from Iraq, the Iraqi government reported Tuesday more than 12,000 civilians died last year. Half died over the last 4 months. December was the deadliest month of 2006, with nearly 2,000 dead. The Iraqi government has been accused of underreporting civilian casualties. The United Nations has said last year's death toll is nearly double the official count. A recent study in the medical journal The Lancet estimated more than 650,000 excess deaths in Iraq since the U.S. invasion. In Washington, funeral services were held at the National Cathedral Tuesday for former President Gerald Ford, dignitaries including former President George H.W. Bush and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger delivered eulogies. President Bush also spoke.
And so when President Nixon needed to replace a vice president who had resigned in scandal, he naturally turned to a man whose name was a synonym for integrity, Gerald R. Ford. And 8 months later, when he was elevated to the presidency, it was because America needed him, not because he needed the office.
President Ford will be buried at a funeral today in his home state of Michigan. At the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon began his term Tuesday as the new Secretary General.
I start my duties with a daunting time in international affairs, starting from Darfur to Middle East, Lebanon, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, many other crises that trouble our world, from defending human rights and to the need to step up our efforts to implement, to reach the target by 2015, the Millennium Development Goals.
Ban is already facing his first potential crisis over allegations UN peacekeepers sexually abused children in Sudan. The Daily Telegraph of London is reporting peacekeepers have been accused of raping and abusing children as young as 12 years old. The UN has up to 10,000 military personnel in southern Sudan. The Telegraph says it's gathered accounts of abuse from more than 20 victims. Back in the United States, new details have emerged in the mistreatment of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. On Tuesday, the FBI released documents chronicling more than two dozen incidents. In one case, guards wrapped a prisoner's head in duct tape after he chanted the Quran. In another incident, a female guard was said to have wiped menstrual blood across a prisoner's face. Military officials and contractors told investigators Pentagon officials, including former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, directly approved the interrogation methods. The new documents were released to the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU is suing Rumsfeld and other officials on behalf of Guantanamo prisoners who say they were abused. In military news, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has called for a repeal of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Writing in the New York Times Tuesday, General John Shalikashvili said the military should welcome any American who's willing and able to serve. Shalikashvili is the highest-ranking retired or active military official to call for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He supported the policy when it was implemented during his first year as Joint Chiefs Chair in 1993. In Massachusetts, lawmakers have approved a measure that could lead to the repeal of the state law allowing same-sex marriage. Massachusetts is the only state in the country where same-sex marriage is legal. On Tuesday, the state legislature voted to advance a proposed amendment that would overturn the same-sex law. The proposal will go to statewide ballot if it survives another round of voting. More than 8,000 same-sex couples have married in Massachusetts since same-sex marriage was legalized there in 2003. Border authorities are being accused of a new case of anti-Muslim discrimination over the detention and deportation of a German man of Syrian descent last week. The man, Majid Shahadeh, arrived in Las Vegas from Frankfurt on Thursday, hoping to surprise his American-born daughter. He was held in a cell for 4 days before being sent home without explanation. In Louisiana, the coroner investigating the shooting death of an African-American mayor-elect has ruled the case a suicide. Gerald Washington was found dead Saturday, just days before he was to become the first black mayor of the town of Westlake. Washington's family has rejected the coroner's ruling and is calling for a state investigation. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, seven police officers charged in the deadly shooting of two people after Hurricane Katrina surrendered Tuesday. The victims, 40-year-old Ronald Madison, 19-year-old James Brissett, were crossing the Danziger Bridge when they came between a gun battle between a group of armed assailants and the seven officers. Madison, who is mentally handicapped, was shot seven times, including five in his back. Four of the officers are charged with murder and will not be allowed free on bail. And finally, this update and a story from yesterday's broadcast. A judge has ruled independent journalist Sarah Olson does not need to testify at Thursday's pretrial hearing for First Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara. Ouattara is facing 6 years in prison over his refusal to deploy to Iraq. Olson is challenging her subpoena to testify based on her interview with Ouattara earlier this year. On Tuesday, Olson was told she will not need to appear at the pretrial hearing, but will remain on the prosecution's witness list. She got the news several hours after she appeared on Democracy Now! And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Baghdad, the Iraqi government has announced plans to investigate why Saddam Hussein was taunted in the final moments before his hanging. Cell phone footage shows masked guards chanted the name of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and then told the former Iraqi president to go to hell. The treatment of Saddam Hussein has sparked protests around the world. Former NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw said Hussein's execution, quote, resembled the worst kind of nightmare out of the old American West. Britain's Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott said the manner of Hussein's killing was deplorable. Well, today on Democracy Now!, we're going to continue our coverage of the execution of Saddam Hussein by airing one of the last televised interviews Saddam Hussein did with an American journalist. The interview actually took place in 1992, soon after Desert Storm. It was in Baghdad and was conducted by our colleague here at Downtown Community Television. 15-time Emmy Award-winning journalist John Alpert. Until now, this broadcast was never aired in the United States. In a moment, we'll play excerpts. But first, John Alpert, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about this interview you did with Saddam Hussein.
Well, everybody was anxious to find out what he was thinking after the Gulf War. Did he feel that he had made a mistake in invading Kuwait? Was he interested at all in trying to find a path to peace? There didn't really seem to be much going on the diplomatic front, and we were fortunate enough to get an interview with him, and he used it to talk about the possibilities for peace and how he felt about the war.
Where did you do the interview?
In one of his palaces. It's really rather exciting journalistic story. They came knocking on the hotel room door at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I could tell from the way they were dressed and their serious faces that this was, these were the people that were going to take me to the interview. And I went to get my camera, because I do my interviews basically from behind the camera, not sitting here like this. And they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm getting my camera." They said, "You can't take a camera." I said, "Well, how can I interview him? I'm not going to do this with colored pencils." And they said, "Get in the car. If you're not in the car in 2 minutes, we're leaving you behind." And they took us to the palace. We walked in, and immediately Saddam Hussein appears, and he came up, he shook my hand, took our photograph. I have the souvenir photographs here. And then he disappeared. And I said, "My goodness, I blew it. There's no interview." And they said, "Just shut up." And took us down to the basement where I had my first and only jailhouse search. They inspected parts of me I didn't know I had. Then took me to a room, and when they opened the door, there were 200 people sitting in the room. The entire crew from Iraqi television and all Saddam's officials, hanger-on, translators, and things like that. And I knew eventually I'd be speaking to him. It didn't happen until later on that evening, but then we conducted a one-hour interview.
Let's go to a clip of this interview.
We're wondering, when the Iraqi army went into Kuwait, did you imagine that the forces were going to strike back against your country as hard as they did?
Yes, we imagined this, and we imagined even more than that.
This is now your chance to talk directly to the American people. And I'm wondering if you could just make a simple declarative statement about your intentions with chemical weapons and nuclear weapons.
لجعل كل منطقة الشرق الأوسط خالية من أسلحة الدمار الشامل.
If it helps make things clear to the American people, then let me tell you that we are ready and willing to work positively with all and effectively with all those who are interested to work in this direction to make the region of the Middle East a region free of all weapons of mass destruction.
We have a new administration in Washington. Do you think that there is any hope now that President Bush is gone, that there can be better relations between the United States and your country?
We are still willing to discuss new relations with the United States if the United States is prepared so to do.
If President Clinton was sitting here opposite you, what would you like to tell him?
When he actually sits in front of me, then I will tell him what I think I will...
And how about if ex-President Bush was here?
من صفات العربي أن لا ينازل إلا من يكون على جواده.
And it is part of the traits of an Arab and values
ويكون
of an Arab.
قد امتشق سيفه.
Not to fight...
الرئيس الأمريكي السابق لم يعد له سيف.
It is part of
وهو قد ترجل عن جواده.
To fight only those who are on their horses with their swords drawn. And now that President Bush is not neither on his horse nor with a sword drawn, then I don't think he
فليس من شيمنا أن
to be fought.
Basically, the people in the United States have come to the point where they don't trust you.
بأنه أكثر من بين أكثر الناس اللي عندما يثق بهم ثقة تكون في مكانها هو الناس الموجودين في العراق.
At any rate, whether the American people trust us or not I don't want to comment on that, but I want to say that the American people are going to discover that the amongst the first people that are worthy of their trust are people here in Iraq.
Many people believe that if, for example, we turn around and we walk away, that you'll be back across the border in Kuwait
tomorrow.
If only we had the means to reach out to the American people and explain to them how the American administration goaded the Kuwaitis themselves to become part of the conspiracy being woven against us, then the situation and the perception of the American people today would have been different from what it is.
Now, whatever you think about Kuwait, Kuwait's a much smaller country than your country. It doesn't measure up to your country militarily, and the same situation exists with you vis-a-vis Kuwait.
And
vis-a-vis
U.S. No, in other words, the United States is a big country, and the United States can push you around, and they did push you around. You were a big country, and you pushed Kuwait around. How can we stop this?
على أقل ما يمكن. هل هو حالة ضعيفة؟
Would you consider any quarter or a government that was announcing at the time that they intended to before the 2nd of August 1990, that they intended to bring the value of the Iraqi dinar to its lowest possible value, and that they had intended to shrink or minimize the revenues and the resources of Iraq to the lowest possible level, would such a government be considered weak?
إذن الحكام الكويتيين استخدموا سلاحهم إلى أقصى.
So the rulers.
لكن سلاحهم هو الأموال.
So the rulers of Kuwait used their weapons to the limit, but their weapon was money.
If the same situation existed again, in your perception, Kuwait, for example, was successful in undermining your economy again, would you do the same thing that you did before? Would you go into Kuwait again if you felt that that would solve your problem?
لا يجوز أن نسأل أسئلة افتراضية ونطلب جواب من رئيس الدولة قائم على الافتراض.
I don't think it would be right to put hypothetical questions and then expect an answer from the head of a state on the basis of those hypothetical questions.
يعني السؤال لازم يقال انه لماذا يستخدمون اموالهم بهالطريقه لتدمير اقتصاد العالم.
The question should be put in this way. Why should they use their wealth to destroy in this way to destroy the Iraqi economy?
المعروف انه الشعب العراق العظيم رغم كل الذي حصل عليه ما زال متمسك بقيادته.
So the fact is, the known fact is, that this great people of Iraq, despite all that has been inflicted upon it, perpetrated against it, still maintains its leadership and still is still attached to its leadership. What does this mean?
يعني هذا انه هو لديه من التفاصيل ومن الاطلاع ما لم يكن متوفرا للشعب.
This means that the Iraqi people is in possession of, is more in possession of the truth. It has more details about the situation than the American public.
Well, in the United States and Iraq are somewhat different. You know, the United States voted out its leadership. We did not have President Bush. Does the Iraqi people have this type of choice? Always when they talk about you, they talk about this is a country that is a dictatorship, and they say that you're a strong man and people cannot disagree with you.
What does this mean?
هذا يعني مع أن الشعب الأمريكي طرد رئيسه.
It means that is at the time when the American people have thrown their president out of the White House.
الشعب العراقي لو كان ما مقتنع بقيادته كان طرده.
If the Iraqi people were not convinced in their leadership, they would have dismissed the leadership.
كان طرده على الأقل استغل مجيء هذه الجيوش والقوات.
Could have at least used the opportunity.
والتدمير الذي وقع على بغداد وعلى كل مدن العراق.
And all the campaign, the military campaign launched against Iraq and the destruction inflicted upon the country.
لكي يقول لقيادته.
They could have used that chance.
لا يستطيع أن يتحمل.
To say to its leadership, well, no, we can no longer take it with you in power.
You're one tough cookie, though. It's not so easy.
انك صعب المركز انك شديد ليس من سهل التعامل معك.
I'm curious if you don't mind. When we go around town now, we see hospitals without medicine. If you want to buy a car at the normal salary, you'd have to work 200 years to buy a car. The people are really suffering. And when you look back at the last 2 years, is there anything that you would have liked to have done differently? Great men have the capacity to look at their actions and say, I should have done something different. And as you look back at what you've done, would you have done anything at all different, possibly to avoid the situation, to avoid the bloodshed, to avoid the war?
لو اطلعتوا لتعرفتم كيف ان امريكا وحلفائها كانوا لا يريدون ان يتم اختيار طريق اخر غير طريق الحرب.
If you looked at the situation then and examined the details and the developments, you would have discovered yourself that the United States and its allies did not want peace to be ensured.
Do you think that President Bush was trying to kill you? For example, when he hit the air raid shelter, when he hit the hotel, there was talk that you might be at that conference at the Al Rashid Hotel. Do you think that you were personally targeted, and how did you avoid getting killed during the war?
إني طلعت على أمور مؤكد وأنا قرأتها بنفسي في مذكرات السيد شوارزكوف.
Unfortunately, I have read things in the book and in the memoirs of Norman Schwarzkopf that would tend to explain to go along those political level.
وفي كل الأحوال، يعني الذي أراد أن يضرب صدام حسين فإن الله كانت له سبحانه وتعالى إرادة أخرى.
At any rate,
هكذا كما
whoever wanted,
ترون الآن.
Whoever wanted to hit Saddam Hussein,
الحمد لله على إرادة الله.
It's God's will that has prevailed, not his, because you see what the situation is like nowadays. It is God's will that Saddam Hussein is here and the others are not.
Saddam Hussein being interviewed by journalist John Alpert just after Bill Clinton was elected for the first time in 1992. When we come back from break, we'll discuss this interview and play a bit more. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my colleague here at Downtown Community Television at the Firehouse in downtown Manhattan, John Alpert, won an Emmy 15 times for his reporting, interviewed Saddam Hussein just after the first Iraq War, just after Desert Storm. John, what we are watching today never appeared on American television, and yet I think it was you and Dan Rather who were the only ones who interviewed Saddam Hussein since the first Iraq War.
That's correct. It's the only time he's ever talked to the press.
What happened? Why didn't this air here?
Yeah, I think it was probably a combination of two things. There might have been perceived pressure from the American government basically just to not give Saddam a forum, even though you would think that If we went to war with him and ultimately went to war with him again, we might be interested in finding out what he had to say, any type of conversation, what he was thinking. We were certainly putting American lives on the line there, and it would be nice to sort of have a little more understanding. But this was the interview that everybody wanted, and I got it. And boy, it made a lot of people in the news establishment unhappy. We ultimately had a handshake from ABC. It was going to be Primetime Live, the main story. But I was told that Roon Arledge decided to kill it.
Roon Arledge was president of NBC.
Yeah, and you know, one of the gods of television news. And it was his idea, and basically they all sort of figured this out, that if they could keep this off the air, then maybe one of their reporters could get the interview. And that's what they did. They sort of all ganged up, a little cabal to keep this off the air. And then they all began calling up Baghdad, pushing their own reporters as substitutes.
But no one got it.
Not in the United States. It was seen all over the world and analyzed all over the world, and there were some actually important news items in the things that Saddam was saying, but never was seen here. It's a journalistic tragedy when you get right down to it. I don't care about myself, but it was obvious that Saddam Hussein wanted to talk in some way to the American people. He had gone to war with us. He would go to war with us again, and this was an opportunity to talk instead of fight.
It particularly made headlines in Israel. Let's go to another clip of the interview that you did, John Alpert interviewing Saddam Hussein in Baghdad.
People in the United States are very curious if you would tell them what your policy on Israel and Palestine is at this particular time. If an accommodation could be reached with Palestine, what would be your view towards the state of Israel?
As far as the Arabs are concerned, they are against discrimination. And they are against any religious discrimination amongst on the level of mankind or on the or within a certain nation.
لا يقيمون علاقتهم مع الناس على أساس نوع الدين.
The Arabs do not establish their relations with others on the basis of religion.
أو نوع العنصر.
Or on the basis of race.
Can you envision an Israeli state and the Palestinians living side by side if the solution was acceptable to the Palestinians?
ولكن السؤال الآن هل تعتقدون بأن إسرائيل ستمنح الفلسطينيين حقوقهم؟
But the question is, do you think Israel is going to give the Palestinians their rights?
أنا أعتقد لا.
I don't think so.
Would you recognize the right of Israel to exist if justice was done for the Palestinians? I said that if they come to a solution that would be satisfactory to the people of Palestine,
then
that would be satisfactory to the whole, to everyone and to the Arab world and to
the Arab.
Because that would mean that the Arabs will be dealing with a new situation.
John Alpert interviewing Saddam Hussein. So this made headlines in Israel.
This was big news. Saddam Hussein saying that he was ready to recognize the right of Israel to exist, that he was ready for peace in the Middle East. They weren't talking those things in those days. When this played in Israel, my phone rang, my cousin was on the phone, Johnny, you're on TV. And the fact that Saddam Hussein was saying, let's make peace with Israel, I can make peace with Israel, was transformative. And it got absolutely no traction over here. And that's a big tragedy. And when you look at the death and destruction that's come in the Middle East, and he was signaling at that particular time, listen, there might be a peaceful way to do this. It's a shame that nobody picked up on this here in the United States.
Finally, the footage that we didn't get to see in the national networks then that you brought back was about the carnage in Iraq after Desert Storm.
Well, it's a suffering that happens in all wars. Some people think that there's justification for this war, justification for that war. In the end, the people on the ground always suffer, no matter what. And the people in Iraq were suffering. They were suffering from Saddam. He was a dictator. He was brutal. And they were suffering from the shortages. They were suffering from the effect of the war. And the people were dying, especially the babies. And when you saw this, and it's something that you'll never, ever forget when you go to the baby hospital in Iraq, then and now. Because the people in Iraq are still paying the price for what Saddam did and the war that the United States brought to them, too.
John Alpert, most recently did Baghdad ER, a remarkable film about the emergency room in Baghdad today.
Right. We're suffering too. I mean, the American soldiers, 19-year-old, 20-year-old, getting chopped up there. So anytime there's an opportunity to talk instead of fight, it's a good opportunity. We should talk.
Well, we're going to go back in time with John Alpert to this footage after the U.S. first attacked Iraq. And I want to warn you, this footage is graphic. John Alpert, thank you.
My pleasure.
At night during the war, 2 years ago, when we visited the Cardassia General Hospital, the doctors had to work under incredible conditions. There was no electricity, but at least they had supplies. Now, because of the blockade, conditions in the hospital are actually worse than they were during the war.
I am Dr. Abdul Ghaffar Hashim. I like to show you some problems what we are having actually every day.
Okay, so can we visit the hospital?
Yes, please.
Okay.
This is the surgical department. Actually, normally this room is nearly filled. And there is a waiting people. When somebody come out, somebody come instead of him to have his surgery. But now, because we can't offer the surgery, it's empty.
How many operations are you doing a day?
Now we are doing about 2 to 3. Before, we used to do about 12 to 15 operations a day.
And what happens to the people that are sick?
Just are waiting. They don't know what to do, actually. This is my supply car.
This is the supply car?
Yes.
But doctor, it's
yeah.
empty.
Yes, it's empty. I mean, it's usually filled with all the instruments which we needed every minute.
So Band-Aids?
No.
Let's look at the pharmacy. Show me the pharmacy.
This is used to be all the types of intravenous fluid here. You can see only this Dexan 40 and this one.
So in the whole hospital, you've only got those two bottles left? That's it?
I mean, this is very, yeah, we have no more.
And what happens when the patient needs the fluid?
You know, it's very difficult. Some of them will die. I mean, this is the burn unit. This kid, if we have the bandages and the cuttings, we will cover him and dress him. But now we are leaving him exposed.
And you don't have any Band-Aids for this kid?
No.
That's horrible.
Of course.
You okay?
So, Alexia?
Yeah.
I'm dying. Oh.
Doctor, what happened to this kid?
This kid has a burn, actually, exposed to burn, and she is suffering from burn. Her condition actually getting worse. We can't cover her because we are running shortages of bandages and cotton. I think she might die. Because, I mean, in another 2 days, she will get septicemia from the infection because we have no proper antibiotic for her.
And does the mother know that her baby's going to die?
Yes, she said yes, I know she is.
Not drowning.
What is she saying, doctor?
She is saying I am suffering, actually. Don't let me suffer more.
Uh-huh. Do you have painkillers for her?
No, we have no painkillers for her.
An excerpt of the footage of journalist John Alpert in Iraq soon after Desert Storm. And for those of us in our radio listening audience, you can go to our website at democracynow.org to see the footage from Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. As we turn now back to this country, the first presidential primary is still more than 12 months away, but the 2008 race for the White House is already heating up. Last week, former Democratic Senator John Edwards announced his candidacy. Today, outgoing Republican Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney will be filing paperwork to form a presidential exploratory committee. One of the most talked about Republican candidates for 2008 has been New York mayor, well, the former New York mayor, Rudy Giuliani. Well, on Tuesday, Giuliani's campaign suffered a possible setback when a New York newspaper revealed what it described as his secret campaign strategy. The New York Daily News obtained a 140-page campaign plan outlining Giuliani's budgets, schedules, fundraising plans. The paper printed excerpts of the dossier yesterday, stating an anonymous source obtained it after it was left behind on a campaign trip. Advisors to Giuliani said the document was stolen by someone who'd infiltrated his campaign. Advisors also downplayed the significance of the document. The main revelations are details about Giuliani's goal to raise $100 million and a listing of his political and personal liabilities. The document reportedly says Giuliani might drop out of the race as a result of insurmountable personal and political concerns. These concerns include his private sector business dealings, his association with disgraced former police commissioner Bernard Kerik, his two ex-wives, and his position on social issues, including his pro-choice stance on abortion. The leaked document has emerged only days after some 9/11 families reported to the New York Post that Giuliani's presidential exploratory committee had begun discussions with them about backing him if he runs for president. Giuliani gained national attention for his handling of the recovery effort after September 11th attacks, but other 9/11 family members have since vowed to reveal the truth of what they say are the failures of his performance during the aftermath of the World Trade Center attacks. We're joined now by two journalists. Wayne Barrett is a senior editor at The Village Voice, where he's been covering politics for 22 years, the author of many books, including Rudy, an investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani. Wayne's latest book is Grand Illusion, the untold story of Rudy Giuliani and 9/11. We're also joined by Kevin Keating, the producer and director of a documentary called Giuliani Time. In a minute, we'll play excerpts, but first, we'll welcome both. And Wayne, start off by talking about the significance of this leaked report, this leaked battle plan, if you will.
Well, not only is it an embarrassment that the president of a security company, who basically his claim to fame and his claim to the presidency is rooted in his supposed security consciousness around his icon status from 9/11. Not only is that very embarrassing, but the substance of the document is really an indictment of the status of his campaign, because the document was written several months ago, a 140-page game plan about who to focus on, and person after person that's named in the document as people that should be focused on by the campaign to pull them into the campaign as prime supporters, many of those people have already signed up with McCain in the interim. And, you know, you take a look at Henry Kravis, for example, who's named in the document, a major Wall Street figure. They say we need to get to Henry Kravis and identify him and pull him into our camp. Kravis was a big Giuliani supporter while Giuliani was mayor. You would think that they could, at least if they reached out to Henry Kravis, hold him from entering the fray so early. But in fact, he's already become a McCain supporter. So it looks like they laid out a game plan and then failed to even execute it. So I think the far more serious damage to the Giuliani campaign is not just that they blew this and that obviously they can't run a secure campaign, but that the evidence that the Daily News has published is evidence that suggests that they're far behind schedule and that they've blown many opportunities to bring some of the major sugar daddies of the Republican Party into line with this campaign. These are now McCain people. I think, keep in mind, everybody in the national news media keeps saying that John McCain is the front runner. That is a total inaccurate report, because Rudy Giuliani has led in 9 out of 10 polls. He's the front runner. McCain's people, I think, have systematically now, I think they're very concerned about how McCain is, about how Giuliani is showing up in their own private polling. And I think they threw a grenade at this campaign very early. And I think it's having dire consequences for the Giuliani effort.
Talk about the significance of Mr. Singer, P.S., yeah, as named in the plans.
Well, Paul Singer is this hedge fund guy who is a big Bush backer and is apparently a very heavy player inside of the Giuliani campaign. What's interesting is that there is memos inside of this playbook that indicate that Paul Singer, this hedge fund guy, was supposed to be in charge of rounding up the 9/11 families to support the Giuliani effort. I can tell you, having just written the book about Giuliani's performance on 9/11, that there's a lot of 9/11 families who are outraged by his performance. You don't have to rely on me. Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton, in their own book, which came out simultaneous with mine, reported that the biggest failing of the 9/11 commission was how they treated Giuliani at that May 2004 hearing, where they gave him a pass on every question, let him tell the same anecdotal speech he usually gets paid $100,000 to tell. And so they said that because the families were so outraged at the pass that he was given, and they wrote this in their own book, they canceled the buses to the final hearing in July or June in 2004 down in Washington. Hundreds of families that were expected to go canceled because they were so offended by the way in which the 9/11 Commission treated the families. Rudy has, I'm sure, some families he can turn to that will support him for president. But there are many families who I've talked to in the course of reporting this book who are outraged by his performance. I mean, the city was about as prepared for that attack, despite the 1993 bombing, as apparently the Giuliani campaign was prepared for some sort of a security leak from their campaign.
Just on these backers who he may or may not have gotten to support him, Rudolph Giuliani, another Giuliani target, FedEx CEO Fred Smith, the uncommitted Paramount CEO Brad Gray, Giuliani's talent agent after 9/11, is envisioned as leading a celebrities fundraising arm. Former Vikings quarterback Fran Tarkenton would raise money from professional athletes. News Corp CEO Rupert Murdoch, PepsiCo chief Don Hudson, Goldman Sachs president Lloyd Blankfein are also listed as industry leaders.
I mean, you know, Brad Gray, for example, has worked with Giuliani for years. The fact that he's uncommitted and that they can't nail him down is another example of weakness. So Brad Gray produced that HBO special after 9/11 that was practically handed over to Giuliani as a production. Everybody that worked for Giuliani exclusively was interviewed for the Brad Gray special on HBO. So the fact that he's uncommitted and the fact that Henry Kravis has been lost to McCain and so many other people who are listed in this playbook. I did as you pointed out, I did a biography of Giuliani in 2000 called Rudy, an Investigative Biography, and they did exactly the same thing when he ran for mayor. I got a copy of a playbook that was a vulnerability study that was 500 or 600 pages long, that was like a recitation of every weakness in his life that he ever had. And I published that in the earlier book. And it seems like they haven't learned anything from that experience.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, Wayne Barrett, also Kevin Keating, the filmmaker who did Giuliani Time, and we'll play excerpts. Stay with us.
People, we gotta get over before we go under. Hey, country, you didn't
The late James Brown, funky president, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are Wayne Barrett and Kevin Keating. Wayne Barrett has written his second book on Giuliani, Grand Illusion, The Untold Story of Rudy Giuliani and 9/11. Kevin Keating has done a film called Giuliani Time, which we're going to play an excerpt of. Kevin Keating, can you link this to the investigation you did in this film, the now explosive new battle plans memo that the New York Daily News got a copy of?
Well, we started making this film just shortly before Wayne wrote Rudy, the wonderful description of Giuliani's background, in which he described this earlier episode where he got a vulnerability report. That's a very graphic scene. He's standing by the throughway at midnight in Albany, and he gets the 500-page report, and in it are listed dozens of vulnerabilities that they had made of their own exposure possible. They actually recommended, as I remember, Wayne, that Rudy not run his own people. I don't know what this latest vulnerability report, if it's that, brings forth, but I would think that Wayne's most recent book, Grand Illusion, with the incredibly important descriptions or revelations about Giuliani's actual performance, moment by moment, on September 11th, and what led up to it, for everything from the Motorola radios and the lack of communication, no command and control center on 9/11, the absolute fallacy of his commanding and being a force for the evacuation on 9/11. It's a scandal. And Wayne's newest book, I think, would be listed high in the list of vulnerabilities for Giuliani. I would hope that our film is there, too, because there are some things that we bring forward in the film about Giuliani's vulnerabilities. For instance, his FBI background check back in the 70s.
Which said
that he may well have deceived the FBI when he was first going to the criminal division about the mafia connections of his family. Not his father, but that his first cousin, Louis DeVanzo, for instance, had been killed by the FBI in a shootout. He was a leader of a stolen car ring here in Long Island. That never came up, and he denies in the film, we found some footage of Giuliani denying that he said he'd been vetted by the FBI, and it may well have been that he had deceived or lied about his family ties to crime back then. That's in the film. I think I'd be very interested to see in this 140-page report what they see as vulnerabilities, because I think Wayne's book certainly is a major area, because he brings forward a lot of new information about 9/11. And nationally, that's what people think, that he actually performed well and gave leadership on 9/11. I think Wayne's book is great evidence that that's not true.
Well, let's go to an excerpt of the documentary Giuliani Time. In this part of the film, Giuliani is speaking at the 2004 Republican National Convention.
And heart of New York City, the Honorable Rudolph Giuliani.
Welcome to the capital of the world. These are times when leadership is the most important. On September 11, I looked up and seeing the flames of hell emanating from those buildings and realizing that what I was actually seeing was a human being that was jumping out of the building, and I was stunned. Without really thinking, I grabbed the arm of then Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik, and I said to him, Bernie, thank God George Bush is our president.
Rudolph Giuliani speaking at the Republican Convention 2004 here in New York City, captured in Giuliani Time, new film by Kevin Keating, which also features the author, journalist Wayne Barrett, who together with Dan Collins wrote Grand Illusion, The Untold Story of Rudy Giuliani and 9/11. Talk about Rudolph Giuliani's performance. I mean, he is seen as, what did they say, America's mayor. This is what he would run on if he does run for president in 2008. And also, I'd like you to talk about his positioning in relation to another New Yorker, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Wayne Barrett.
Well, you know, Kevin's film shows this speech. I think the speech, and I've known Rudy since the 70s. I met him when he was a private attorney.
You were friends, weren't you?
Yes, and I wrote positively about him and still feel positively about many of the things that he did as a United States attorney here in New York. I'd say that this speech was the lowest point in his public life. It was maybe one of the most acclaimed point. But what disturbed me the most about this speech, and it goes to your question about 9/11, is that he is the person who cemented this falsehood in the American mindset about the connection between Iraq and 9/11. Because at the start, the very start of this speech, before a national audience, he reminds people about the bullhorn speech that Bush delivered immediately after the attack down there at Ground Zero, and says, he quotes Bush again as saying, the people who brought down these towers are going to hear from us. Well, we all know that the people who brought down these towers have yet to hear from us. But then he says, they heard from us in Afghanistan. You could make an argument that people who brought down the towers were based in Afghanistan. But then he says, they heard from us in Iraq. When even Dick Cheney has admitted that the people who brought down the towers had absolutely nothing to do with Iraq. And he, I think, in that moment, he crystallized for the American public, because he can speak about 9/11 with greater authority than any other American figure. It's a myth that he should be able to speak with such authority about that, and that's the myth that the book deals with. Now, Rudy had many dear personal friends who died that day, and yet he would, at a national convention, completely misrepresent who killed them. And I don't think you can get any lower than that in public life. So my feeling about, and what we try to lay out, Dan Collins and I, in this book, is we take a look at the many good things he did say on that day and in the immediate aftermath of that. He hit all the right chords with the American public. He said all the right things. But we examine how he did all the wrong things between the 1993 bombing. He was running for mayor in 1993 when that bombing occurred. He took office just months after the 19.
This was the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center.
Of the World Trade Center complex. All the mistakes that he made, whether it be locating the bunker in the World Trade Center complex, and let's just look at that one as an example. I mean, we have chapters on the radios. We have chapters on command and control. We have chapters on
the radios not being able to communicate.
Right. The firefighters were using the same radios that they used at the 93 bombing, even though we found the report that was written in 1990 that said that they were already obsolete and that they were a danger to the life of firefighters. And the firefighters are still carrying those same radios 8 years after the 1993 bombing. And but what we focus on, I mean, just take the bunker, for example. It turns out we discovered memos where his top security advisors say you can't put it in the World Trade Center complex. We discovered a 5-page memo from Jerry Hauer, who was the head of emergency management under Giuliani, that wanted it to be located in Brooklyn in the Metrotech complex. That happens to be roughly where Mike Bloomberg has since put it. It's a block away from Metrotech in downtown Brooklyn. Giuliani said, no, I want it within walking distance of City Hall. No one could figure out the security rationale for that. But once he said it had to be within walking distance, Jerry Hauer then said, you can't go underground because it's all below the floodplain within walking distance, so you got to go to a tower. The nearest tower was the World Trade Center complex. The 23rd floor of 7 World Trade had never been rented. It was built for an investment banking firm as a trade floor. It had extremely high ceilings. It had lain vacant for more than 10 years. The private landlord who owned that became a gigantic donor to Rudy Giuliani, threw 2 big fundraising events on his yacht for him. They move into that floor, and it is a disaster on that day. We quote people from John Farmer, who was the staff attorney who wrote the chapter that deals with the city's response for the 9/11 Commission, as saying that if they had had a functioning command center that day, it would have saved the lives of many firefighters and police officers and rescuers. They had no functioning command center. They had no functioning command center because of terrible decisions that were made. Even Howard Safer, who was the police commissioner appointed by Giuliani, who goes way back with Giuliani to his federal days as a prosecutor. Even Howard Safer warned him. We quote from a meeting of the cabinet in which he called it in 1997. He said, you can't put it in Ground Zero. He called it Ground Zero then because it had already been bombed. Rudy just brushed aside all of this advice, was determined to put it there, put it there, and it had dire, even deadly consequences that day. So that's just one example of many that we raise in the book.
What about the police and firefighters who came to try to find loved ones, partners, colleagues? What about the environmental hazards of 9/11?
Well, Amy, you know, the terrible thing that happened on the fifth anniversary that we all just commemorated was that all the national news media had Giuliani on. I watched every channel the night of the fifth anniversary. Every network had Giuliani on, the same self-serving statements, the same hero worship. Here, our own local channel in New York One, had the head of the police union, the head of the firefighters union. Both of them were condemning Giuliani. They don't have to negotiate any more contracts with them. This is not union leaders blustering about a contract. They had to be embodying and representing the vast majority of their membership. They pointed to our book and said our book told the truth about how Giuliani responded. And they denounced him, not just for the lead-up to 9/11, but for what you raise, which is we have two chapters in the book that point out Giuliani's terrible responsibility for, look, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, you can understand the chaos. You can understand why firefighters and police officers are out there without respirators. They're still trying to do rescues. But once it was clear that nobody could be rescued, why there were thousands of construction workers, as well as these first responders, working there without respirators and with no plan to get them respirators, and why they were exposed to these toxins, and why we now have thousands of them who have respiratory and even cancer signs right now, severe respiratory difficulties, why that was allowed. You know, Giuliani, we quote the head of his own commissioner from the Department of Design and Construction who ran the Ground Zero cleanup. He said he dealt with Giuliani every day, that Giuliani only asked him one question: how much debris did you remove yesterday? Are we on schedule? Are we ahead of schedule? All he cared about, even though the fires were still burning and spewing toxins in the air, all he cared about was the public relations. Obviously it's 5 years later, nothing's been built there. What was the rush? The public relations question of making it look like they were efficiently cleaning up the site. And the consequences have been dire.
Yet, Kevin Keating, this is a very different picture than we get in the rest of the media. Certainly, you're presenting a very different picture in Giuliani time than we get anywhere else.
Well, I think the media hasn't shifted all that much from what they were doing during his time in office, which is essentially genuflecting. And you know, when Giuliani appears to this day on Tim Russert or Matthews or any of the national news media, they, as I say, genuflect. They radiate in his glow. They too feel that he's a rock star when he walks in the room. There's almost no critical analysis. And I don't think any of the major journalists have read your books, Wayne, or seen our film, for instance. I mean, when it comes to Giuliani, there's a kind of a sycophancy and a adoration that kicks in that I still don't understand, because even the most cursory investigation of Giuliani will quickly bring to the surface how his mayoralty wasn't nearly what it's touted to be.
Well, we have to end the show right now, but I do want to invite you both back because there's a lot more to talk about, and certainly in the film, to bring us part two. And it's not just about 9/11, especially when we're looking at the shooting of Sean Bell today. It goes back to issues of police brutality under Giuliani and how he responded, for example, in the case of Amadou Diallo. I want to thank you both for being with us. Wayne Barrett, author of Grand Illusion, Kevin Keating, filmmaker who did Giuliani Time. That does it for our broadcast. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Sheriff Abdelkadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Richin, Aaron Mate, Anna Noguera, Lee Burek. democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.